Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 439, update on September 11th. This is being recorded on December 22nd of the year 2003. We're going to return to the subject of the Bank al-Taqwa and the Muslim Brotherhood. And bear in mind Dr. Youssef al-Qaradawi, the fellow we just were reading about in Side 1 or on Side 1 of this program. We're going to turn now to an article that was carried in the Boston Herald. This article is a special report by Jonathan Wells, Jack Myers, Maggie Mulvihill, and Kevin Wisniewski. It's from the Boston Herald of October 28th of 2003, and this was accessed on the website for the Charlie Rose PBS program. It's titled, Radical Islam, Outspoken Cleric and Jailed Activist Tied to New Hub Mosque. This is one of the things that's so problematic about the whole issue of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it is a fascist organization that is deeply embedded, so to speak, within one of the world's great religions, and a religion that is practiced by over a sixth of the world's population, and because many people simply do not understand what the Muslim Brotherhood is or how it actually, the beliefs it espouses. It has permitted not only the radicalization of sincere Muslims who have been deceived into what is essentially a viewpoint that is being manipulated by literally a fascist organization with historical links going back to the Third Reich. But in turn, this is also played in the hands of extremists who can then turn around and point to Muslims who are sincerely ignorant of the ways in the history of the Muslim Brotherhood as extremists. The result is polarization. The result ultimately will be destruction, not only for the United States, but also ultimately for much of the Muslim world, Israel, and perhaps much of the Christian world as well. The beneficiaries ultimately will be the underground Reich. Again, the Boston Herald of October 28th of 2003, Radical Islam, Outspoken Cleric, and Jailed Activist Tied to New Hub Mosque. The first Islamic organization poised to build the largest mosque in the Northeast on a site in Roxbury has long-standing ties to an Egyptian cleric who praises suicide bombings and a Muslim activist indicted last week in a terrorism financing probe. The Islamic Society of Boston, which has city approval to build a sprawling $22 million Islamic Cultural Center and Mosque on Malcolm X Boulevard, has had a long association with Dr. Youssef Abdullah al-Qaradawi, whose vocal support of the Palestinian terrorist group Hamas prompted the State Department to bar him from entering the U.S. 4 years ago. Parenthetically, as we looked at in Dollars for Terror, he also was connected to the bank. He's one of the founders of the Bank al-Taqwa. The local religious organization, now headquartered on Prospect Street in Cambridge, was founded by Abdurrahman Muhammad Alamoudi, a high-profile Washington, D.C. activist who has publicly supported Hamas, Hezbollah, and other terrorist organizations. Alamoudi also represented by Grover Norquist. Another personality who highlights some of the intrinsic difficulties, not only understanding the Muslim Brotherhood, but also in combating fascism, both in the Islamic world and here in the United States, and that concerns the Ramadan family. Saeed Ramadan was the son-in-law of the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and his sons, Tariq Ramadan and Hani Ramadan, have also become prominent Muslim leaders in Europe, and this is causing problems in Europe as well as the United States. The following is from the International Herald Tribune. This is an article by Elaine Scolino of the New York Times, S-C-I-O-L-I-N-O. It's from Monday, November 17th of 2003, from Muslim leader Devotion and Suspicion. This is Dateline Saint-Denis in France. It reads in part, of all the Muslim leaders in Europe, perhaps none has more visibility and more faces than Tariq Ramadan. To many experts on Islam, Ramadan, a 41-year-old Swiss-born philosophy professor, is a respected scholar who promotes a moderate, tolerant version of Islam from his headquarters in Geneva and in his lectures around the world. To his Muslim followers in the rough suburbs of France, he is a spiritual guide whose passionate speeches and cassette tapes inspire them to throw themselves and their beliefs into Western society like a, quote, bomb, unquote, he says on one cassette tape, even as he tells them to become model law-abiding citizens. To a number of French intellectuals, he is a dangerous demagogue whose words have multiple meanings and are laced with anger and anti-Semitism. Who is Tariq Ramadan? Read the front-page headline in the daily tabloid Le Parisien on Friday. Below the headline, there was a color photo of a pensive Ramadan, a hand on his bearded chin. Ask Ramadan the question, and he will say that he is a misunderstood man. In an interview on Thursday in an office he keeps in this working-class Paris suburb, he fiercely denied that he was anti-Semitic and attributed the campaign against him to his popularity. "I have so many students and followers in the States," he said, noting that his writings are used in American courses on Islam and that he is invited to lecture all over the world. "Look at my new book," he said, citing the internet version of a book titled Western Muslims and the Future of Islam, soon to be published by Oxford University Press. It's the product of 15 years of work. Skipping down. In 1928, his grandfather Hassan al-Banna founded the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, an Islamic revival movement that preached a return to Muslim values as part of the struggle against Western colonialism and decadence. The group is now banned in Egypt. In the 1950s, the family was sent into exile by the Egyptian leader Gamal Abdel Nasser, and Ramadan's father, Saeed Ramadan, moved with his relatives to Switzerland. There, he created an Islamic center that became a place of pilgrimage for figures like Malcolm X. Ramadan's brother Hani won notoriety in France and was suspended from his job as a high school French teacher in Geneva after he wrote an essay for Le Monde last year that justified stoning women as punishment for adultery. Skipping down. Of an assessment of Ramadan by Bernard Kouchner, a French socialist and also someone who was attacked for his Jewish faith by Ramadan. In an interview, Kouchner, since he's from France, a foreign aid advocate and a former health minister of France, called Ramadan, quote, absolutely a kook with no historical memory, unquote, and, quote, a dangerous man, unquote. He added, again quoting, the way he denounced some Jewish intellectuals is close to anti-Semitism, unquote. In a joint essay in the news weekly Le Nouvel Observateur, three leading French socialists accused Ramadan of committing a crime against the Republic with his words. Quote, we cannot allow people to categorize French citizens according to their race, their origin, or their religion, they said, adding, quote, what Tariq Ramadan has done is to sow hatred and racial discord. Ramadan, who is in France to take part in a major anti-globalization conference, has strongly denied all the charges. One of the problems with a situation like this, and borrowing a term that became extant during the Iraq war this past spring, term is embedded. One of the things that the Ramadan family illustrates is the difficulty when you get someone of the persuasion of the Ramadan family embedded within the Muslim faith, and when you get many sincere Muslims around the world basically being exposed to the Muslim Brotherhood and having their mosques. In most cases, most Islamic congregations are relatively poor, which gives the Muslim Brotherhood, in turn, closely allied with many of the wealthy oil-producing states, not only of the Persian Gulf, but also some of the wealthier interests in Indonesia, an opportunity to fund the Muslim Brotherhood. And when you take the many desperately poor people who adhere to the Muslim faith around the world, you have a really explosive combination. Tariq Ramadan, again, is one of the two sons of Saeed Ramadan. We've talked about Saeed Ramadan in numerous broadcasts, including For the Record program numbers 343. We talked about it in 381, 377, 381, and 382 as well. We're going to return to the book Dollars for Terror and of the relationship between Saeed Ramadan and François Janoux, one of the top operatives of the Odessa, one of the people involved in the post-war distribution of Nazi funds, and somebody who was inextricably linked with the Al-Taqwa milieu. We read, let us mention only the incident of the treasurer of the FLN, at the center of which the banker François Janoux may be found. Ramadan and the Muslim Brothers thought they could play a part in the Algerian process as they had done in Palestine in 1947. Saeed Ramadan thus left Munich to settle in the city of Calvin. And again, more about François Genoux, and we'll discuss him briefly later. Of Ramadan Tariq, of Tariq Ramadan and his relationship with his father, skipping down. Like his brother, Mr. Ramadan Tariq, Mr. Ramadan Hani is thus an important figure in the European Islamist movement and entertains close relations with the Union of Islamist Organizations of France, or UOIF. This association has participated in demonstrations in favor of wearing the Islamic headscarf, and its sympathies extend to the Palestinian movement, Hamas, unquote. And more about François Genoux and his relationship with Al-Taqwa. This was carried in For the Record program number 352. This, in turn, is from the San Francisco Chronicle of March 12th of 2002. It's an article by Jay Bershinsky, headlined, Swiss Probe Anti-U.S. Neo-Nazi. And this is about, among others, Ahmed Huber and the bank Al-Taqwa. Of François Genoux and his alleged relationship to the bank Al-Taqwa, we read, authorities believe Genoux founded Al-Taqwa Bank and allocated its resources to support international terrorists such as Vladimir Ilyich Ramirez, alias Carlos the Jackal, and bin Laden, unquote. And reviewing again the relationship between Youssef Nader, the founder of Bank Al-Taqwa, and German intelligence, the Abwehr, and in turn, the relationship between Youssef Nader and Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and SS Major, the driving force behind the founding of three Balkan Muslim Waffen SS divisions in World War II, the uncle of, distant uncle of Yasser Arafat, and the person whose protege Yasser Arafat is, we read, another valued World War II Nazi collaborator was Youssef Nader, current board chairman of Al-Taqwa, Nader Management, the Lugano, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, and Bahamas-based financial services outfit accused by the U.S. Treasury Department of money laundering for and financing of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. As a young man, he had joined the armed branch of the secret apparatus, Al-Jihaz al-Siri of the Muslim Brotherhood, and then was recruited by German military intelligence. When Grand Mufti al-Husseini had to flee Germany in 1945 as the Nazi defeat loomed, Nader reportedly was instrumental in arranging the escape via Switzerland back to Egypt and eventually Palestine, where al-Husseini resurfaced in 1946. So again, noting the road to Lugano and some of the historical links between the Muslim Brotherhood on one hand, the underground Reich on the other, and the GOP and the Bush administration, bear in mind the of volatility and the explosiveness of that situation. One of the ways that's being deflected, I suspect, relatively consciously, certainly by the underground Reich, certainly by the Saudis, by elements of the Muslim Brotherhood, and quite possibly by the Bush administration as well, is basically deflecting this in the direction of anti-Semitism. Certainly, although the Bush administration officially supports Israel, it has supported essentially the right-wing government of Ariel Sharon, and the right-wing of the Likud party itself has a fascist history. But to make a long story short, in terms of any sort of geopolitical economic considerations, Israel is irrelevant to anything that's substantively meaningful in terms of world economic life. It's a small place. It has no oil. None of the Muslim countries in which there is an enormous disparity of wealth is controlled by Jews, let alone Israelis. And essentially, in terms of economic impact, Israel's importance in the world as a whole is zero. But one of the things that's been taking place in connection with the 2000s so far, the 21st century, is a scapegoating of Israel and Jews in general for all sorts of problems that don't essentially have anything to do with those. And I suspect that in so doing, it's kind of like a misdirection play in football. Basically, people are being led in the opposite direction from political and economic reality. Nonetheless, anti-Semitism is becoming the vogue once again. The San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, December 14th of 2003, had the following article by Veronique Mistan, Jody Beale, and Elizabeth Bryant. It's Dateline London and headlined, fears of anti-Semitism sweep Europe. Leftists and intellectuals blaming Israel for world's ills. This reads in part, on Britain's National Holocaust Remembrance Day, the Independent newspaper runs a cartoon of a bloodthirsty Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon devouring a Palestinian baby. Despite many complaints, it is named Best Cartoon of 2003 by the UK Political Cartoon Society. Anti-globalization groups in Germany invoke old stereotypes of Jews as global manipulators by suggesting that Jews played a major role in planning the Iraq War and in the events of September 11th of 2001. A book alleging that the CIA and Israel's Mossad intelligence agency conspired to plot the attacks on New York and Washington sits on the German bestseller list for months. That in and of itself, not surprising. What is interesting is that the attacks were generated in Hamburg, Germany. German intelligence had the cell in Hamburg under complete physical and electronic surveillance from August of 1998 on. There was a German conspiracy book that actually has had a certain amount of republished circulation in the United States, had a beauty in assessing why how the world's intelligence community operates. It said basically that the BND, that's the German Intelligence Service, and the outgrowth ultimately of the Galen spy outfit, the BND is controlled by the CIA, and the CIA is controlled by the Mossad. Well, no doubt, and it's because Israel has all of that oil. And, of course, the economic impact of all of that Israeli oil is paramount. One of the things that I suspect is going on, too, is a deliberate misdirection play. One of the think tanks that has helped to generate the Bush administration's policy in the Middle East, and something that's had a lot of publicity, considering that people right, center, and left generally react reflexively to the notion of conspiracies, and they go, ooh, I don't believe in conspiracies, isn't there such thing? And yet the Project for a New American Century, a think tank with roughly 30% Jewish membership, some of the Jewish members of the neoconservative movement, has been getting an awful lot of airplay, and naturally this is seen as the sort of the linchpin of the Jewish conspiracy behind September 11th. And Project for a New American Century does have considerable Jewish participation, but its primary people are not Jewish by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, they are Republicans connected to the Bush administration and to the petroleum industry. I suspect the deliberate floating of the Project for a New American Century is basically an attempt at deflecting the policies that have unfolded in the Bush administration onto a, quote, worldwide Jewish conspiracy. Taking a look at the people who basically staff the Bush administration, it's worth perhaps taking a good look at who some of these people are. The President of the United States, George Walker Bush, is a former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas. The Vice President of the United States is Dick Cheney, a former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas. The Undersecretary of State for Middle Eastern Policy, who basically has more to do with the actual execution of U.S. Middle East policy, is Elizabeth Cheney, the daughter of Dick Cheney, the former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas, who was the Vice President of the United States. The Commerce Secretary is Don Evans, a former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas. We saw earlier that Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, said that we had absolutely sure statement on May 16th of 2002, and I will read again from this article on CBSNews.com. Condoleezza Rice stated, I don't think anybody could have predicted that they would try to use an airplane as a missile, a hijacked airplane as a missile, said National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice on May 16th of 2002. Quote, how is it possible that we have a National Security Advisor coming out and saying we had no idea they could use planes as weapons when we had FBI records from 1991 stating that this is a possibility, said Kristen Breitweiser, one of four New Jersey widows who lobbied Congress and the President to appoint the commission. Well, Condoleezza Rice is a director of Chevron. By the way, the Secretary of Energy is Spencer Abraham, an Arab-American former Republican senator from the state of Michigan, who lobbied vigorously for the abolition of the Department of Energy that he now heads. His former press secretary, by the way, is Ann Coulter. Well, taking a look, and by the way, we should also note that the Bush administration's energy policy has been very heavily guided by a think tank at Rice University that is chaired by James Baker, the former petroleum, former Secretary of State under the first George Bush. By the way, the first George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, is a former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas. And CIA headquarters is named for George Herbert Walker Bush, the former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas. So no doubt, U.S. policy is undoubtedly being guided by the Jews. Tricky bastards. Never know what they're going to do next. The whole farce, in particular, it's interesting to see the so-called progressive sector, which has generally eschewed any notion that there were conspiracies, there was no conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination, and a great many other things that were quite obviously conspiracies. I would also know one of the linchpins of the current so-called progressive sector is none other than former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, associated with the International Answer activist group. Ramsey Clark was the assistant attorney general who helped to coordinate efforts with the Warren Commission initially. Ramsey Clark was attorney general of the United States and helped to frustrate not only Jim Garrison's investigation into Kennedy's assassination, but he helped to cover up the assassinations of Martin Luther King and also Robert Kennedy in 1968. And Ramsey Clark is currently one of the people heading up the International Answer, which is a very interesting thing indeed. In the book, The Washington Payoff, Ramsey Clark's father is identified as a protege of Carlos Marcello, the former capo mafioso of New Orleans. And the alleged payoffs between Carlos Marcello and Clark's father were going on well into Clark's tenure, not only as Attorney General, but also when he was on the Supreme Court as well. That's Ramsey Clark's father, Tom Clark. So again, it's quite interesting to see the evolution of some of these things. But no doubt, it's an international Jewish conspiracy. The whole thing is sort of embodied. I'm ruminating here a bit, but I was in Berkeley for a speaking engagement, Berkeley, California, that is, a couple of months ago. And there were a couple of bumper stickers, rather, displayed calling for a cutoff of U.S. aid to Israel and saying end the Israeli occupation of Palestine. These were strategically displayed on the back of a Jeep Cherokee. And that sort of embodies the whole thing. Of course, Jeep Cherokee is a very fuelish vehicle. It's a sport futility vehicle, as I call them, or a dumb V. And it's those vehicles that are more of a problem than some mythical Jewish conspiracy, which is not to say that I hold a brief for Ariel Sharon, but Ariel Sharon himself and the right wing of the Likud party are viewed with extreme distaste by many people in Israel. But at this point, a lot of the people in Israel are frankly scared squatless of the current state of affairs. But again, the structural relationships between this administration and the petroleum industry, and in turn between the petroleum industry and elements of the Muslim Brotherhood and the overlapping Wahhabi sect of Saudi Arabia, it's one of the reasons why we are not seeing an investigation into the substance of many of the events in and around September 11th. We're going to take a look now at a column by Molly Ivins that was carried in the San Francisco Chronicle. As I mentioned, the Vice President of the United States is Dick Cheney, former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas. His daughter, Elizabeth Cheney, is the is Assistant Secretary of State for Middle Eastern Affairs. Molly Ivins' column was carried in the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, December 19th of 2003, and again noting the structural economic relationships between this administration and the petroleum industry. Skipping down, this column was titled Hypocrite's Oath by Molly Ivins in Los Angeles. Speaking of Halliburton Oil, formerly headed by Dick Cheney. Speaking of marvels of hypocrisy, the UN's book on who dealt with Iraq are not all that shrouded. For example, one of the disgusting companies actually making profits from dealing with the despicable dictator, parenthetically Saddam Hussein, in the 1990s, long after his depravities had become evident to even the less attentive sectors of the world, was, well, golly, look at this, Halliburton. Between 1997 and 2000, while Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton, the company sold $73 million worth of oil field equipment and services to Hussein. At least, Halliburton was not selling luxury cars to the Baathist elite. Parenthetically, we're going to come back to that in a second. Halliburton, the oil field equipment company, merely kept Hussein's oil fields pumping, the only thing that allowed him to stay in power. Halliburton cleverly ran its business with Hussein through two of its subsidiaries, Dresser Rand and Ingersoll Dresser, in order to avoid the sanctions. Well, as we looked at last week, one of the business associates of Neil Bush is a guy named Jamal Daniel, originally of a Christian family from Syria. But the Daniel family, as we looked at last week in an article from the Financial Times of London, were one of the founders of the Ba'ath Party in both Syria and Iraq. So what we want to be looking at here is the structural economic relationships and some of the fascistic ideology that stems from those rather than any particular ethnicity. And the unifying element in these structural economic relationships is what Texans call the all business. We'd also note, in an historical note here, I mentioned that George Bush's father, for whom CIA headquarters is named, was a former petroleum industry CEO from the state of Texas. As we looked at in RFA 37, among other broadcasts, and there was also, for the record, 367. In fact, I'm quite sure it was 367. George Bush's, that's the elder George Bush's first job out of Yale University, was with Dresser Industries. Now, that's now a subsidiary of Halliburton Oil. Dresser Industries was the first employer of the elder George Bush, and the elder George Bush got that job as a result of networking between Henry Neal Mallon and his good friend, Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell. Henry Neal Mallon was a member of Skull and Bones, as were both Georges Bush and also Prescott Bush Senior. So again, noting the structural economic relationships, and also I want to emphasize, this will seem like utter fantasy to some members of the listening audience, but looking at Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, who were two of the point men in establishing the Islamist connection to the Republican Party and to the Bush administration, they also, as we looked at in For the Record 412, which were the point men in cutting taxes in this country and the result of building up spending in order to finance a war at the same time as you're slashing revenues, is basically threatening the United States with economic destruction. Ultimately, that economic destruction will result in its political annihilation as well. We looked at that in For the Record 412, something that we're going to take up again in connection with the state of emergency. And as I'm speaking on December 22nd, we have once again an orange alert. And one of the things that is an outgrowth of the events of September 11th, and one of the reasons that I think the standard leftist conspiracist analysis of September 11th as basically a provocation in order to justify U.S. imperialism is basically BS. It's much worse than that, actually, is the fact that the United States, this ain't how you do imperialism. The U.S. faces destruction. From the Yahoo website, a Reuters story, Dateline Washington, cash-strapped cities grapple with security costs, and we're going to deal with this next week. The country is being bankrupt by the combination of terrorism and tax cuts. Norquist, Karl Rove, and others are the link between those. That concludes For the Record program number 439. Update on September 11th, being recorded on December 22nd of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.